This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition. The late lamented Rabbi Jonathan Sachs believed that out of the science of positive psychology and in conversation with cognitive behavioral therapy, a new Mussar movement could be established. In this episode of the Tradition podcast, Tamra Wright and Mordechai Schiffman begin to unpack what this might mean in light of their co-authored essay, Radical Resilience, Hope, Agency, and Community, from Tradition's recent special double issue on the intellectual legacy of Rabbi Sachs. They're joined for the conversation by that volume's co-editor, Samuel Liebens. Together, our three guests explore the relationship between hope, agency, and community. They consider whether Rabbi Sachs was unduly harsh on optimists, and discuss why he placed more faith upon philosophically inspired psychology than upon the main contemporary schools of academic philosophy. What does it mean for Torah to be in conversation with a science like psychology? What does it mean for students of a rabbi to turn their critical gaze towards their late teacher, who now becomes an object of their ongoing research? Visit traditiononline.org for more information about this very special issue and to order a copy, or even better, to subscribe to our journal and never miss an issue. Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Schiffman is an assistant professor at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School and the associate rabbi at Kingswood Jewish Center in Brooklyn. Dr. Tamra Wright is a senior research fellow at the London School of Jewish Studies. And our host, Rabbi Sam Liebens, is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Haifa. Here's their conversation.
Hello. So I'm Sam Liebens, one of the co-editors of the special issue of Tradition dedicated to the intellectual legacy of Rabbi Sachs. And as you know, I'm here with my friends and colleagues. We've decided we're going to drop all honorifics and we're going to go with first names with Tamra Wright and Mordechai Schiffman. The paper that they have written together, the main title is Radical Resilience. It's a paper that explores Rabbi Sachs's contribution to what you, the authors, describe as resilience discourse. And the subtitle is Hope, Agency, and Community, which alludes to some of the more conceptual work that the paper achieves in relating Rabbi Sachs's understanding of hope to his conception of agency, and how even the agency of a given individual is, according to Rabbi Sachs, rooted somehow in belonging to a community. So before I get to anything else, you need to explain something to me, because I know Mordechai because I've had the pleasure of spending Shabbatot in his community, and I've had hospitality in your home. And I know Tamra for many, many years through the London School of Jewish Studies and our shared affection and love for Rabbi Sachs, and we've done research projects together and whatever. But I didn't know that you two knew each other. How do you two know each other?
Okay, I'll take that one. I'll say it's through the miracle of Zoom.
Okay.
And so a few years ago, I was teaching a summer school course for Revel, and Mordechai, who already had a PhD in psychology, was taking the course in Jewish philosophy. And so I got to know him that way, and we realized that we had this shared interest, not just in the thought of Rabbi Sachs, but how it interfaces with psychology. And so when I was invited to contribute an article to the special issue of Tradition, I basically said I'd be happy to do so, and I want to collaborate with Mordechai.
Wonderful. And we were only too happy that occurred. And Mordechai, so I know more about Tamra's connection to Rabbi Sachs through the London School of Jewish Studies and having lived in England, despite her North American accent, having lived in England for a long time. How did you, I mean, I know that you have a connection to Rabbi Sachs, but what could you tell me more about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I only had the privilege of meeting Rabbi Sachs once, a dozen years ago or so, when he was coming to YU for his professorship. And I used to work at the no longer existent Center for the Jewish Future at YU. And
my job was... Future.
There is a Jewish future, but the institution of the Center of the Jewish Future doesn't has not made it into the current time frame. But Rabbi Sacks was speaking at the Kol Yom Rishon program, and it was my job to actually be his bodyguard, to take him from his car to the podium and then back again. And that was the one time I was sort of fanboyed on getting to meet Rabbi Sacks. I did not have a personal relationship with him.
You already knew his work by then.
Basically a few years before that, when I was in Smicha at YU, we were preparing drushos, and somebody said, you know, you have to read Rabbi Sacks's drushos and his essays. And I started, and I got hooked, and I read To Heal a Fractured World, and my mind was blown at his ability to communicate ideas in such a profound way. And then, you know, if you can see on my bookshelf here, this is my Rabbi Sacks bookshelf, and it doesn't even have everything there. I bought in, and I dove right into everything that he said, and watched all the videos, and I really integrate so much of his thinking into my work, into my writings, into my speeches. When my class at Revel, when I took the Modern Jewish Philosophy class with Professor Wright, I can't drop the honorifics, you know, she's my professor. But I was actually so excited because in Radical Resilience, in the end, she has an article where she introduces the concept of a new Musar, which Rabbi Sacks suggested, to combine cognitive behavior therapy and positive psychology with Torah through a Torah lens to create a new way of character change. And I am someone who is trained in cognitive behavior therapy and someone who does research and has an expertise in positive psychology. And this is exactly like what I want to do. And I was like, wow, I'm so delighted that I now have a stronger connection, and we've developed it and cultivated over the course of a few years. So it's been amazing.
So I want to, in a moment, I want to circle back, Mordechai, to your research in both cognitive psychology and positive psychology, and how that links to Rabbi Sacks' notion of a new Musa. But before I do, Tamara, maybe even though I might know more about this, our audience won't, and I'm sure they'd be interested to hear your personal connection to Rabbi Sacks over the years, and how you got to know him, and how he moved from being perhaps a teacher and a mentor into being somebody whose work you're interested in researching and engaging with.
Okay, Sam, that's a great question. I'm just trying to decide how long of an answer I'm going to
give.
So let me start by saying, currently I'm in Israel, and it's 40 years, a little bit over 40 years since my first trip to Israel, which was life-changing, and also a little bit less over 40 years since I moved to England for a year. And after I moved to England for a year, I realized that first Coventry and then Birmingham were not the thriving Jewish centers that I was seeking. And I found myself in 1987 in Northwest London. I made a new friend, and my friends, finding out that I was interested in ethics and writing a PhD on Emmanuel Levinas, told me, you have to go and take a course with me that I'm taking at what was then called Jews College.
Yes.
And it's a course with Rabbi Sacks on Jewish ethics and its relation to secular ethics, philosophical ethics. So I did that. And I have this very clear memory of being given the address of this place called Jews College, and turning into this little tiny residential road in Hendon, and looking at these terraced houses and thinking, did they give me the wrong address? Have I made a mistake? Am I in the wrong place? Where is this college? Anyway, I found this college, had a setback, as you know, you both know, setback from the road. And I joined as an audit student into this class on secular ethics and its interaction, comparison with Jewish ethics, and it was absolutely wonderful. And that was great. And that was my first exposure to Rabbi Sacks. I have to admit, I didn't know at the time how exceptional he was. I think I just kind of thought that English rabbis are very clever people. Anyway, I took that course, enjoyed it very much. And at the end of that academic year, in the summer, I got married, as you know, my husband, And he had a relationship with Rabbi Sacks. So Rabbi Sacks actually married us. So he had that sort of significant role in my life at the time. And then a few years later, actually, I want to share one story, if I may, and then I'll tell you more. But the story is this. A few years later, I got a phone call from the chief rabbi's office just before Rosh Hashanah. And so the chief rabbi, you know, Rabbi Sacks, chief rabbi, was speaking to me, asking a few friendly questions, told me how much he had enjoyed an article that I'd written that year. And I thought, well, this is all very nice. I wonder what he actually wants. And eventually, I said to him something like, oh, chief rabbi, thank you so much. And what is basically, what is the purpose of your call? And is it Ian that you want to speak to, or did you actually want to speak to me? And he said, Ian, no, Ian, my husband. Yeah. He said, no. It's just my minhag, my custom is that before Rosh Hashanah, I like to call scholars whose work I've appreciated over the course of the year. And
that's
so
a special story, Tammy. You've not told me that before.
Yeah, I like that one. I mean, I think I mentioned it to him many years later, or somebody in his office, and they said he had to give that up because he got so busy.
He read so much.
I know. Yeah. But and then, so I was teaching philosophy at what was then Jews College, and I was editing the journal, La'ela, and we went through various phases at what became London School of Jewish Studies, of which Rabbi Sacks was first the principal and then the acting principal, and so forth. So I spent a lot of time over the years in discussion with him, or just sitting in the audience and listening to what he had to say. So I wouldn't say we were best buddies, but he has been a very important figure in my life. And then in terms of positive psychology, which is what you're asking about, or this new Musser thing. So I was intrigued when I heard him mention this idea once or twice in his teaching. And
somehow, the idea being that somehow out of the resources of these new movements in the world of psychology, a kind of new or renewed Musser movement could be articulated.
Yeah, and it was part of his bigger understanding that Judaism needed to be in conversation with important secular knowledge and developments in the secular world. So this was for him, it was just like one example that he kind of threw out a couple of times in his teaching, but that's the one that sort of took my fancy. And then when we put together a book of essays in his honor on the occasion of his retirement, it was sort of obvious to me as one of the editors that that's the direction that we should go in, getting people both in terms of Jewish study scholars and mainly philosophers from the secular world who he had quoted and been interested in interacted, and getting them to write. And
I wrote McIntyre, who wrote a chapter for that book. What's the title of that book, Tamara?
It's the short title is Radical Responsibility.
Radical Responsibility. It was a Festschrift.
However, Gila Fein, who was the editor-in-chief at Koren at the time.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Do you want to read us the subtitle?
What's the subtitle?
Celebrating the Thought of Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. But you said Festschrift, but that was the F word that got banned by Gila Fein, because she felt that people don't read such collections. Yeah. It's an off-putting kind of word. And that, you know, a book of essays in honor of Rabbi Sacks really needed to reach a wider market and have people actually keep it on their shelf and read it.
It's a marvelous collection. And like you said, Mordechai, you probably read Tamara's piece as part of this course, right?
No, it had nothing to do with the course. I just knew the piece because I was reading everything that was put out related to Rabbi Sacks. Yeah. And I knew about it, but I didn't, again, I had no connection to her. Then when I saw she was teaching the class, I'm like, oh, that's
So I wanted to, I'm going to come back to Tamara in a minute, because part of what I wanted to speak about is, was left unsaid. But I want to bring you back in, Mordechai. as the professional psychologist in the room, in our virtual room, what do people mean by positive psychology? I mean, it sounds nice.
Sure. Okay, so positive psychology is a movement that was started close to around the turn of the century by Martin Seligman and his colleagues, where the basic vision was that he was the president of the American Psychological Association, and he created this movement which said that psychology tended to focus a lot on healing mental illness, which it should. And it should focus on how to heal people and help people who are suffering. But in addition to that, psychology can have a voice in how to help people thrive. He gave the way he framed it is like, if you take somebody, psychology focus on taking somebody who's at a -7 to bring them to a -2, right? That's healing through therapy. But let's say you have somebody who's a +2. So psychology is not going to say anything to them. But what if we created some sort of system that can help that person who's a +2 become a +7? And that's what positive psychology tries to do based on the philosophical underpinnings of this are somewhat complicated, but based on Aristotelian thought related to character and virtue, they developed a system of 24 character strengths, which the argument was that if you invested and had the self-awareness of what your strengths were and lived your life through those strengths, that will lead to flourishing, which mm-hmm. relates to Aristotelian thoughts of eudaimonia, and Rabbi Sacks spoke about this in a few times, different aspects of what simcha versus ashrei was, mm-hmm. which is something that I'm developing in a future project. But that's
a big word, yeah. Eudaimonia. It's the kind of the good towards which human life is aimed, according to Aristotle, is variously translated. Sometimes as happiness, sometimes as health. Sometimes you mentioned the word flourishing. And Rabbi Sacks had this interest in simcha. Already what you say helps me to see why there might be a link to Musa, because first of all, psychology may have for some people the connotation of, as you said, fixing mental ill health, whereas Musa is for everybody. Whereas you might think that psychology is only for people who are in some sense or other unwell, Musa's for everybody. And then not only are you saying that positive psychology is designed for everybody, the notion that it focuses on character traits, again, is very resonant of the Musa movement. So I see, am I basically right?
Yeah, I mean, correct. And in addition to that, that's where the cognitive behavior therapy piece from the new Musa comes in, because we're still considering how to help people who are suffering from some level of mental struggle. We can help them as well. That is part of Musa, part of tshuva, part of repairing. We all need repair. And the truth is that cognitive behavior therapy as well has elements of it that aren't just for somebody who's struggling with anxiety or depression, but there are techniques and strategies. I actually just taught yesterday to my class at Azrieli to teachers about stress management. And we used therapeutic techniques from cognitive behavior therapy in order to help sort of teachers who are not even struggling, but just regular daily stressors of classroom and school culture, how to bolster and help themselves deal with that in a proactive way using cognitive behavior therapy techniques. So putting those together with Jewish thought is something that can be incredibly powerful. These are industries that are spending, millions and millions and millions of dollars to figure out the best practices and best strategies and how to help people thrive. Why not marry that with the wisdom of Torah and Musar to help people live better lives?
Absolutely, absolutely. Tamra, so to cycle back, because I asked you first about how you knew Rabbi Sacks personally, but then there's this transition from being somebody who you know, somebody who taught you, somebody who, was a character in your life story, to being an object of your study. And it's been a funny thing for me too, because Rabbi Sacks was a very important figure in my life, but it's only really since he died that I've gone back to his work with a kind of professional critical eye, You and I, we co-led a research group in the aftermath of his untimely passing, in which a number of scholars who were equally touched by Rabbi Sacks's life, we read through all of his works together. And I did feel this kind of, oh, he's gone from being our mentor or our teacher or somebody that we just loved to being somebody who we're studying. Anyway, the question I want to ask you, again, speaks to our two biographies, yours and mine, Tamara, in that you have grown up through continental philosophy, which is kind of one branch of philosophy since basically the turn of the 20th century, a little bit earlier than that. But you've grown up through that branch of philosophy. And I've grown up through this branch called analytical philosophy. And in a sense, Rabbi Sacks disdained both of them.
Yeah.
He always thought of analytical philosophy, I think, at its worst. He thought of it as kind of pointless navel gazing with lots of formalism and mathematical logic, but it's not going to change your life. It's not going to address, because I work in metaphysics and things, and he would say that's fine, it's interesting, but is it going to actually change how you live? So he was a little bit disdainful of the branch of philosophy through which I got. But in your paper, and I don't want this conversation to be a spoiler. I want people to go away and read this article that we're talking around rather than. But one of the themes of the paper is the positive psychology that Monaho is helping to explain. But there is a kind of sub theme which is relevant, I think, to Rabbi Sacks's negative attitude towards the continental tradition, right? So maybe you could pick up on that, Tamara. You know, what was his problem in a nutshell?
Okay, it's a great question, Sam. And I think if people want to get an answer to this question from the mouth of Rabbi Sacks himself, the place to go is his TED Talk. Right. And he gets a little bit autobiographical in his TED talk, and he talks about being an undergraduate at Cambridge and being, I don't remember the exact words, but there's something like, you know, he was immersed in existentialism and thinking about alienation and the lack of meaning. And he says something like, I was sort of self-obsessed and miserable to know.
I was thoroughly dislikable. Yes,
this kind of thing, right?
I have the paper in front of me. I was full of ontological uncertainty and existential angst. It was terrific.
So the humor comes out there, which is great, and the self-deprecation, everything else. But I think there is this, and you know, I've written a little bit about this over time, but there's a movement in Rabbi Sacks in the way that he talks about philosophy, and he talks about his own approach to philosophy. And there's this kind of movement away from what you said, kind of navel gazing, or, you know, a kind of almost an intellectual superiority and all these kinds of things, into thinking about how do we use, let's just say, generally intellectual tools to help people make their lives better.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where I think that the kind of philosophically informed thinking that he did kind of naturally overlapped with positive psychology and CBT and this question of a new muscle. It's like, okay, so, you know, there's good quality academic research out there. There's good quality, great minds thinking about important issues. How do we interact with that from a Jewish perspective? And also not just take it on wholesale, but evaluate it from a Jewish point of view.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that if he thought that positive psychology was going too much down the road of happiness and the individual, he, you know, in his essays, he says that's not the way to go.
He would be critical of that too.
He would be critical of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, at the when I was writing that piece for Radical Responsibility, I was in the back of my mind, like thinking a little bit programmatically and without making Mordecai blush too much, it's like the ideal reader would be somebody like Mordecai, who's very grounded in Jewish tradition, in Jewish text, and in the psychological literature, and not in an ivory tower way, but, you know, interacting with real people as well, right? And so that's, you know, I would love to see more people doing that kind of work. And it doesn't have to be, and I'm kind of getting back to the question you asked about Rabbi Sacks as a object of study, right? Yeah. It doesn't have to be, well, let's write more and more and more about what Rabbi Sacks said about positive psychology, but let's kind of follow his lead and some of those clues and take it forward.
I mean, that's really important. Like in my own work, I have written more about Rabbi Sacks since he's passed away. I do cite him often. I'm in conversation with him. But I don't really want to be, in my own work, a Sacks scholar, because I don't think Rabbi Sacks would have wanted me to be that. He'd want me to articulate, you know, my own religious experience as I see it, informed by him and others. Mordecai, I've got two questions for you. First of all, because I can't remember, and I'll ask them both, and you can answer them whichever order you like. But I can't remember, in addition to teaching psychology, are you also practicing psychology, so to speak? And the second question is, and this just comes from rereading your paper today in preparation for our talk. Do you think it could be said, and actually Tamara's helped me set me up here, because the point is we're not supposed to be merely reproducing Rabbi Sacks's work, but branching out in new directions. And sometimes that's going to require criticism. So my second question is, do you think Rabbi Sacks was perhaps unduly harsh on optimism?
Sure. Okay, so the first question, I'm not sure if there's a follow-up to it, but yes, I do practice psychology. I'm a therapist, again, trained in cognitive behavior therapy. In terms of, was Rabbi Sacks critical, perhaps too critical of optimism, I would love to have this conversation and ask him about it. You know, when we were writing the paper, and we did a lot of thinking about this, and this was a recurring theme in so many places, Rabbi Sacks plays up hope as something that is essential to Judaism, and turns away from optimism as something that is not essential to Judaism at all, and even sounds like it's almost problematic. And the difference, distinction that he made was that optimism was a belief that things will get better, and hope is the belief that we together can make things get better through our agency. And that's a key aspect of our paper that we developed over the course over thinking about it deeply. But our original problem was, like, if you read the psychological literature, hope is great, but optimism is also great. And there's even, it was interesting that he followed the distinctions, the definitional distinctions that exist in the psychological literature, that there is a, hope is the belief that things get better with the agency. But again, optimism itself also has a benefits, positive benefits to it. So I would love to ask him what he thought about it. My original assumption was that it was a rhetorical move, right? Just like he believed in optimism, and optimism had its place and its he was an optimist. And there's no reason to doubt that. But just because it was so essential for him to emphasize hope as something that we can do something together, that we can build, that we can improve, that we can make the world a better place. He, as a consequence, optimism got was the stepping stone to be able to get there.
So that was your first thought. Your first thought was maybe it's a rhetorical device. And he was a public intellectual speaking to a large audience, so he needed to use some of these tricks sometimes. So really, he's pro-optimism and he's pro-hope, but he wants to show the distinctive virtues of hope, so he does it in this way of comparing hope and optimism, where optimism comes off worse off than hope. But you implied that you've rethought that position.
Well, I still think you need to have some aspect of that, because at the end of the day, it's unless the answer is is that if we're going to promote optimism, that there's an inherent passive tendency that comes with optimism. Meaning, so that might be the danger of it. If we promote it, then people aren't going to take the agency. That would make it problematic on its own. So that is definitely possible. And I can see that, right? I can see that people who are thinking just optimistically, there it's sort of like, Hashem will provide, I don't have to do anything. And while Rabbi Sacks would believe that Hashem will provide, he would also say, and you have to do something about it. So I think that's probably somewhere where it's coming from. But what it led us to, and I'm happy for Professor Wright to take over on this one, what it led us to through, again, thinking through this deeply, go ahead, Chavrusa on this back and forth a few times, was, I think, a tremendous insight that isn't, it's not exactly clear, it doesn't write it explicitly. When you put all the things together, when you put the downplay of optimism, the advocating for hope, and then the agency plus the togetherness, which it takes sort of gets us to our subtitle, really calls together so many essential aspects of Rabbi Sacks' thought that I think do puzzle, put together in a puzzle piece to help bring out what he was trying to communicate with hope. But I'm happy to do that. And the comparison. Yeah, I'm happy to do that, but I think that let Professor Wright take the lead on putting the puzzle pieces together if you want to go in that direction.
Just to remind your listeners that the subtitle is Hope, Agency, and Community. And I would say that what you mentioned there, it reminds me of the Talmudic phrase of Halacha Ve'ein Morin Kein, that there are some times where something is true, but we don't necessarily have to teach it. So that's to say, it could be the case that optimism is good, that psychological literature shows that optimism is good, but maybe promoting optimism might be counterproductive, whereas promoting hope, won't be counterproductive, perhaps. But yeah, Tamara, without spoiling too much the thrill of the paper itself, maybe you want to say something about those three puzzle pieces: hope, agency, and community.
So actually, what I want to do, Sam, is take you back several years. We were having coffee, I believe, on Emek Rephaim, and one of the things that we talked about was that it would be wonderful if we could get some philosophers together to think about the ideas, the distinctions that Rabbi Sacks makes, and that he doesn't spend time going into in a huge amount of detail, and to really delve into them. And the example that you gave was the distinction between hope and optimism.
Yeah, I mean, to be really brutal, because I put it in a way that might, God forbid, sound disrespectful to Rabbi Sacks, which I hope everybody knows wouldn't be my intention. But I put it to you, I think, that Rabbi Sacks had some sound bites, kind of favorite kind of sound bites, that can almost sound like they're a cliche, but actually they're philosophically pregnant with a huge amount of significance. And it would be good, I said to you, if scholars could sit and take some of his favorite sound bites, so to speak, and unpack them.
Okay, so first of all, thank you for putting that idea in the back of my mind. And secondly, I do actually want to hand this question back to Rabbi Professor Mordechai Shiffman, because I think he's got good grounding in the psychological literature that will be helpful to us here. So over to you.
You've got three puzzle pieces.
Three puzzle pieces.
Hope, agency, and community.
Correct. So I think actually one of the things that can bring out this distinction and sort of help see why Rabbi Sacks might have had a trouble with optimism is there's some literature that shows that, let's say, somebody unfortunately is diagnosed with some very serious disease. The literature tends to show that giving them optimism, they're trying to train them to become more optimistic, actually can backfire, because optimism is assuming that their things will get better. And there are some situations where the reality is that they won't. So trying to inject optimism in a situation that is doesn't allow for it or makes it so far-fetched actually backfires. But hope to give somebody, not that things will necessarily be fully fixed, but there are things you can do to help towards that, regardless of the optimistic outcome that things are going to be perfect, can be beneficial. And that sort of gives us, you know, part of that puzzle piece where optimism might be problematic. But once you insert agency into it, now somebody has something they can do about it. They can be active. They can try. That has benefit to it. Then the third aspect that sort of pulls this out from the psychological literature, which we were researching, is distinctions between hope and optimism in the early onset of COVID, where there might have been some challenges to being optimistic. You're not sure what's going to happen, but also hope was problematic because what am I supposed to do? We felt almost lost. There was very little agency to be had. And that's where the third puzzle piece comes in. And that's where, Professor Wright's the one, I think, who, when we were thinking about this, sort of helped us pull these together tightly. During COVID, Rabbi Sacks wrote about how together as a community, as a nation, whether that's in England, whether that's Klal Yisrael, whatever we're talking about, as a community, different people, even if as individuals, we can't do everything or anything to make a difference, but together we can have an impact. And that's why when you reread Rabbi Sacks, what he's writing about hope, he's pulling these things together. It's hope is a combination of agency, but agency isn't always enough. You need to have agency in a community so that we together can help each other and make a difference.
Yeah, and thanks, Mordechai. That really helps, I think, to paint a picture that resonates with something we've said earlier on in this conversation. So Rabbi Sacks was trained not as a psychologist, he trained in academic philosophy, really, with some other interests along the way in economics and law and what have you. But philosophy was the bread and butter of his education. And yet he came away at the end, I suppose, with a kind of dissatisfaction with the continental tradition, a dissatisfaction with the analytical tradition, and moves in the direction of actually schools of philosophically rich schools of psychology. What you've said helps to paint some of the richness there, because there's the communitarian aspect. Rabbi Sacks was deeply interested in communitarian philosophy, a school of philosophy that situates the individual within a community. So this notion that agency, individual agency can only get you so far, I think Rabbi Sacks had philosophical reason to think that, in a sense, there's no such thing as complete individual agency, because there's no such thing as an individual without the context of a community. So I've got one more philosophical question for Tamara and one more research-based question for Mordechai, and we've got 5 minutes on my clock. And this one's really unfair, Tamara, because I didn't prepare you for this, and you've got like 2.5 minutes. But Nietzsche appears in this paper, and I wanted to give people the teaser for that. Rabbi Sacks has a strange relationship with Nietzsche, because he seems to adore him and think he was one of the most profound philosophers around, and also to be very scared by, you know, the vision that Nietzsche, you know, reveals on the world. Could you summarize what you take to be Rabbi Sacks's kind of relationship with Nietzsche?
Ooh, ouch.
So I didn't prepare you.
There's a cliche in podcast circles, which is great question.
They should give you some time to think about what to say.
Yeah, it is something. So one of the things that I would say is I think it's actually a more general phenomenon in terms of Rabbi Sacks's relationship with the continental philosophers. Which we've spoken about already. And I think that some of the time he will write about them almost as a caricature of what their positions really were, right? And you know, does it mean he hadn't read them and thought about them very carefully? No, I don't think it does. I think that what it means is that, again, you use the phrase public intellectual, right? And he was, to some extent, using those continental philosophers, not quite a straw man, but
as a fall guy, as a foil,
as a kind of fall guy, and saying, you know, and also, like, in defense of that, excuse me, a lot of people think that these little caricatures of those philosophers are the sum total of what they had to say.
Yeah.
Right. And what he's trying to present is a different view of society, or a different, you know, or a Jewish view or whatever.
To the received continental tradition, or to Nietzsche as he's been received by public, you know. But it does seem to me that he thinks of Nietzsche as having recognized more vividly than anyone in the continental tradition the consequences of removing theology from your intellectual horizons.
Yeah, he does. And we actually quote that in the paper.
Yeah.
When he talks about that, right? So some of the time he's in critique mode and he's critiquing Nietzsche. We didn't really talk about that, but you're absolutely right. He does say, you know, if you read Nietzsche, you get this vision of what, of the reality, the long-term reality of a godless world.
Yeah. Somehow no one else articulates it as well, or something like that. Mordechai, my question for you is just simply, you teased us with something yourself when you spoke about Simcha, about perhaps future research directions in your Sachs scholarship or Sachs inspired scholarship. Would you be able to tease us some more in the last couple of minutes of our conversation?
Sure, I would love to. So, you know, a few of the things I failed to mention before in terms of my relationship with Rabbi Sacks was that, God willing, I am now a part of the cohort 3 of the Sacks scholars as part of the Rabbi Sacks legacy, which is very exciting. And we have to do a project. So I'm going to tell you about the project in a second. But I also have a job, a director of leadership scholars at Yeshiva University, which is part of the broader Sacks-Herrenstein Center. So we have, with Dr. Erica Brown, Elise Abrams-Koenig, we work with students, and we, you know, last trip, we went to England, and we met with so many of Rabbi Sacks's family and everybody. It was really a tremendous trip. One of the things that I did for them was actually, I guess I could plug my new book, was The Torah of Character, which I wrote essays every week for the Parsha, which combines psychology and Torah. But every essay, because it was part of the Sacks-Herrenstein Center, has a quote from Rabbi Sacks. So I was basically living with Rabbi Sacks's work and trying to integrate it into my writings.
Rabbi Sacks would just be shining in pride, because like Tamara was saying, you know, he saw cognitive behavioral therapy and positive psychology as this source of great potential for Torah scholarship. So to see a professional doing that, you know, as you do on the weekly Parsha, just think that's wonderful. But yes, carry on.
Thank you. No, that's very meaningful to me. I really appreciate it. And it's one of my main regrets is that I wasn't able to connect with him with these ideas on a personal level. So one of the things that I'm working on thinking about is trying to really take Professor Wright's idea about a new Mussar from Rabbi Sacks and really put it into play. It's through the best practices of positive psychology and cognitive behavior therapy, you know, I'm thinking about how I actually have an acronym of ASHRAE, which based on Rabbi Sacks says ASHRAE is the word for, you know, for flourishing, and each one sort of targets and hits another value, a core value that's important for flourishing, for Jewish life. A is achrayut, S is for simcha, for that positive emotion. H is for hishtadlut, that effort, that agency. The R is for the reut, the friendship. E is for emunah, the spirituality and the meaning. And the I is for the iyun, the intellectual engagement. And really, you know, there's a whole framework here based on, you know, emerging, it's not it's not everything from Rabbi Sacks, but it's emerging from Rabbi Sacks, and it's emerging of this integration that I believe can have a tremendous impact in moving that new Mussar idea into schools, into shuls, into the Jewish community, and into the world beyond, demonstrating how Jewish values with the best of modern day thinking, psychology, and philosophy can really help people live better lives, and together, as you know, with take agency, live together communally, and really try to change the world to be a better place for everyone.
Beautiful, and I think that really embodies what Tamra was saying, that yes, Rabbi Sacks has become an object of our study, but he would want us to be developing new fields of study, hopefully inspired by the things he said, and that's exactly what you're talking about doing. Rabbi Professor Schiffman, Professor Wright, thank you very much for your time. I'm so thrilled that we were able to include your fabulous paper in our special issue of Tradition. For me, it's very meaningful because Rabbi Sacks, as a young man in 1975, published his very first essay in Tradition. And now, all these years later, we've managed to, what is it, a full 50 years later, have come together to celebrate his intellectual legacy in this journal that first showcased his work. And thank you for sharing your research with us and the listeners of the Tradition Podcast.